Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
Can't eat, can't sleep, I'm so nervous I can't keep the beat. I can't run. Drifting and drifting like ship at sea, your love is killing me.
You know, somebody stopped me recently and asked me what that song was that always plays. It's from my man, Huey Lewis and the News. They're the best. They are amazing. HueyLewisandTheNews.com is the place to go, the official Huey Lewis and the News. The tour is coming up, man. May 18th, Catoosa, Oklahoma. Then they go to Kansas and Oklahoma again. They're coming around to Westbury, New York and New Jersey come June time frame. And I'm really excited about that. That is Huey Lewis and the News. It's a really rare song that they gave away called Your Love is Killing Me. I bet you if you look around, you can find it. And they're just amazing. I'm waiting for them to put a new album out. Really. I don't know if they're going to do it, but I am really waiting for them to put a new album out. But we got all kinds of good music from them. And if you ever get a chance to see them live, you got to go check it out. They're just awesome. So it's 8:35 Sunday night. Sitting down to record the podcast. Hope to get to it earlier this weekend, but full of activities over the last couple days. Got to take a break here in the middle, so it's going to be a long night. I have a work call at 9 o'clock. Yeah, it's been a lot of long nights for work lately, weekends. You've heard me say this a couple times in the last few episodes. A big launch coming next weekend. Hopefully we'll get a bit of a reprieve after that, but so it goes. Let's talk about what we have going on this episode. It didn't have a ton of chance. I have all these topics, but not a lot of time to prep them through. So it's going to be a lot of a roundtable kind of weekend this go-around. Let me tell you what I got. Non-painted hives. They have a feature on what to do if you don't want to use paint. And if you do want to use paint, what are your best choices? In the roundtable section, half-hour intern, a little short jaunt on beekeeping. Comb honey. What's a good way to get it? How do you set your hive up for success in that way? A question and answer on leftover uncapped honey. What do you do with it? JZBZ cage, mentioned by Joe Lewis, which I'll talk about in that segment. Ultra Breeze guy. May he rest in peace. Radical extractor. You have to check this thing out. And somebody sent me a note about using rhubarb for varroa control. Yeah, we'll sneak all those things in and see if we can find anything else to put in. But let's go ahead and get started with the local hive report. So for the local hive report, it's been an unusual March. We're almost to the end of it, and it's been, I'll say, colder than I would expect it to be. Most of the evenings have been down in the 30s, some in the 20s, and harsh, which is really upsetting because the flowers came out, crocuses, the snowdrops or whatever, then we got a snowstorm, and everything's dead, and then it got warm for a day or so here or there. And the crocuses are back out in the yard, and even our Andromeda, which is out front, is starting to bloom. It seems really confused. You would think this time of the year we'd be in the 45, 50, 55 as a high every day, but it hasn't been that way. It's been 40 and below, with 20s and 30s and even, you know, almost down to teens in the evening. So it's been a cold March. This past Saturday was the first break in the weather. A pattern blew in where it got to be 60, 65 degrees during the high. It was rainy and overcast, a little drizzly here, some rain. And that was just enough to melt the snowstorm that we got a week or so ago where we got 8 inches here in New Jersey. It was actually like 12 inches, but then it rained in the end and compressed it all down. And the snowblower broke, and boy, that sucked. So all the snow is melting, the ground is wet, the bees are out flying, and they've been trapped inside the hive, and there's fecal material all over the outside of our hives in both the house and the farm. One hive left at the house. It's the three deep sitting on the hive scale. It's 151 pounds right now. It was 173 when we started into winter, so you can see how much it's drawn down. My intent Saturday was to go into the hives, do a quick hive check, see how the population was, where it existed, what kind of food they had, and if I got brave enough, I was going to crack the hive open if it got really warm and do a mite check. Unfortunately, we went out for an activity in the morning on Saturday and just got stalled and stalled and stalled and delayed, and we didn't get back until late in the afternoon. So by the time I got out to the hive, it was 5 o'clock, and it started to get cooler. It was just below 60 degrees, and I really didn't want to break the hive apart. I think it's still cold, plus there's cold days ahead in the forecast. However, I wanted to get into the hive and see what kind of shape they were in, so I took the roof off, I cracked the inner cover, and I took a look. A lot of bees in this hive. It looks good. I'm really happy with the hive at the house here. Looks strong, and I could see them really working in the camera all week long when they get warm enough days. And it has been just 45 degrees, and these girls have been out flying. So they're pretty much troopers. And, you know, I think this hive is in good shape. One of the things I noticed is they had propolis everywhere, which a lot of people don't like, but to me, I think it's a sign of a healthy hive. So as I looked down, I could see some stores in the hive. I think they're in good shape. They were in three boxes. They're starting to build for spring, and I just left them alone. They're 151 pounds. It's a little light, considering they were 170-something going into winter. But I suspect that as I go out and check them, as they're sitting on a grain scale, I'll just keep moving that up, and they're going to start gaining at this point. One of the things that happened is that I had the nucleus hives that I've talked about in previous episodes sitting there. They've got a little bit of food in them, and the bees chewed through the tape that I had used to close them off and were in robbing them. I let them have a little bit. They were only going to get one day. I think it's going to be too cold the next couple of days for them to get over there, and I'll seal them back off again. So after I poked in the hive here at the house, I hopped in the truck and went over and took a look at the farm. A little bit nervous as I pulled in. The bees were flying that day. I see bees flying in the poly. I see bees flying in the, what I call the package hive. I didn't see anything coming and going in the top bar hive. And no activity on the all medium hive. I pulled up, got out, tapped on the all medium hive, and immediately a bee emerged. And I knew that hive was okay. I brought the FLIR camera and I started shooting pictures of it. And I could see they were pushed right up into the top box underneath the roof. So we lit the smoker, popped the top off, took a look down into the inner cover, could see some bees, popped the inner cover off, and the hive has some stores in it, and it has, you know, a reasonable amount of bees, not a big cluster, I don't think. But they're still alive in there, which is really a good thing. As I said in the last episode, once you get to this point, hence all the funny weather, I would have thought we would have been good to go, but there are flying days. They are bringing in pollen, and I think they will probably be okay. Just to be safe, I put a little fondant and a small pollen patty on it, and I buttoned the hive up and closed it. Over to the top bar hive, no bees coming, popped the top off, popped one of the inner covers off, and no activity. So this hive is not there anymore. I started poking around in the frames, and darn if I didn't see a 7-inch rat in there. The thing was huge. Its tail was as thick as my pinky. I pulled all the frames apart, chased it out, and plugged the hole so that it can't get back in. And the hole is probably thick as a finger for the bees to come and go, and darn if that thing didn't crawl right through that hole. I was amazed how big that rat was and that it got through that little hole. So I plugged the hole, I put the roof back on, and darn, another year did not get that top bar through. Recently, I visited another beekeeper who has a top bar about that size, and her comment was, and I looked at her, her hive looked like a sausage. It was just wrapped and wrapped and wrapped in insulation. And I think what I'm going to have to do is make sure that I have a super strong hive and wrap the thing in insulation to get it through. And if it gets through one winter, I think it will have enough bees to sustain is the word I was looking for a period of time. You know, be able to overwinter. So, darn. Pop the top, look through the inner cover of the package hive. It's okay. I don't think it has a ton of bees in it, but it made it through. I took the FLIR camera and I looked at the poly hive. Wow. The top two boxes were glowing. The thing looked like a firefly. It was amazing. That box is humming. I know there's a ton of bees in there. When I pulled up into the yard, they were just hammering out of the entrance going to get whatever they could find. So the poly hive is amazing in the spring. I'm positive that when I crack that open, it's going to have a good population. So I didn't do real well on the nuke situation and was hoping that all four of the hives over the farm would make it. The top bar didn't. The other three are still going, and the one at the house looks really good. I think I'll have enough stock to get started with here in spring to make my splits and grow my operation, and I'm really looking forward to doing some nukes and getting things going. So not as good as I want it to be, but not terrible either. I think I learned some lessons, and I definitely think I'm going to take some changes next year in insulating the hives and being more aggressive with that, especially with the top bar. And I want to get, again, my Waré in and some of my other hives, including a garden hive that I have this year, going. So I'm definitely at a want for bees. And hopefully my swarm traps that I have deployed will pay off. I got one other swarm trap still sitting in the breezeway. I'm going to have to get that out. But thinking about how to find some time over the weekend, next weekend, to get it out, since swarm season is going to be right around the corner. So local hive report, check. It is what it is. Looking forward to the next couple weeks of it finally getting warm in here in New Jersey and seeing some blooms and then getting to the beekeeping season in earnest. Let's go ahead and jump into the program. For segment number one, finishing is the name of the segment. Someone asked me recently, is there a way to finish your hives naturally without chemicals? I think anything that you put on your hive, except for water, is probably a chemical, and others would argue with me that water is a chemical, but it's a fair question and one I've considered a few times in my tenure as a beekeeper. For my Waré hive and my cedar hive, I didn't want to paint them. Unlike this person who I think was looking to avoid chemical paint systems, I simply wanted to show the beauty of the wood, so I was choosing alternate treatments. It's not that I care for the volatiles in paint systems. It's just simply I wanted the hives to look good, like woodworking. For the cedar hive, I chose linseed oil. I really wanted it to have a nice golden hue to it. And I really liked the color of the wood and wanted to maintain that forever. That's what my goal was. In fact, the other day I was thinking, as I was seeing these boxes, they're not deployed right now, how terrible they looked. That mission was not met, and I know the reason why. What got me to thinking about it is I recently refinished my leather boots with linseed oil and paste wax that I made with beeswax. And what I realized is you had to keep applying the paste to the boots until they got soft and supple and they were quote-unquote saturated with the linseed oil and beeswax and then dried, and then they got a nice finish to them. As in the case with the cedar hive, I put two coats on and let it dry because I was in a hurry to get into the beekeeping season, and I think, since I need to refinish them again, I'm going to take a different approach. What I learned from the boots is apply it, let it dry. If it's not wet looking or saturated, apply it, let it dry. And apply it and let it dry. Once it gets to the point where when you're putting it on, it doesn't feel like it's soaking into the wood, you got it. And I think that's the approach you have to do with this in order to get, one, something to look good, and two, to keep it a natural finish for a longer period than a season. I was really disappointed that the hives were out there for a season, maybe a season and a half. The linseed oil finish, which I thought I put on pretty heavy, had worn off and the boxes start to gray. Now, a lot of people go, well, that's nice, Kevin. Cedar grays and it looks great. I didn't want that. I wanted it to remain the natural wood color. And it changed over far faster than I wanted to. Now, I don't know if I saturate the wood, whether this will make a huge difference in how long it lasts before you have to refinish it, but that's the ways of natural woodworking. On a more recent occasion, I used EcoWood treatment for my Waray hive. That and the swarm traps that I put out turned like a Hershey chocolate brown when I put them out after being exposed to the sun. And I thought they came out really nice, and I was happy with that. On the Waray hive, I still would have liked to have retained a little more of the natural color of the wood, but the fact that it turned brown and it was uniform was okay with me. So in both cases, I was trying to maintain the color of the wood. And if you really want to do that, the easiest answer is don't do anything. There's this funny deal that if you put a roof over top of your hive and protect it from the onslaught of rain, if you put, you know, some sort of finished wood out there, for the most part, it would stay that way for longer than you would imagine. So the first strategy is maybe don't do anything at all. Just create something to protect it from the sun and the elements, and it'll look nice. So, of course, you know, that's probably not the greatest idea. So another route people take is coatings, dippings, pressings. You can mix a formula of beeswax and some sort of oil, like olive oil, and different parts per mixture, and paint a hive with it, and it will protect it. You could set up a vat like you're going to roast a turkey at Thanksgiving and dip your hives in boiled oil, and sometimes people put resins and other things in there, and they impregnate their wood with wax and other things, and they'll never go bad. Or you could just choose to use some sort of alternate coating of oils like I did. The kind you might eat or the kind you get out of nature from trees and so on. Can't say what would be best if you were choosing one that you would eat. If you think about oils, at least what I know, is they're referred to as dry oils or wet oils. Dry oils change from a liquid to a solid film at some point. They chemically dry is what I'll use the term. You can think of linseed, tung oils, even a converted soybean or soy oil are considered dry oils. Then you have the derivatives of those, where they're mixed with something that creates more of a varnish or a blend. For whatever reason, and I don't know why, these are often referred to as Danish oils. They're a varnish and oil blend of different proportions depending on what manufacturer you use. If you're confused whether you're using an oil, a varnish, or a blend, one of the things you could do is take whatever the product is and spread it on glass and leave it to dry for a couple days. If it's a Danish oil, or if it's a varnish or whatever, it dries differently. Dry oils will dry with a hard, smooth finish on glass because it's not porous after a couple days. But anything that has oil will retain like this soft, bubbly, wrinkled-looking piece. And the idea of that is if you'd paint it on a substrate like wood that wasn't finished, it would soak it in and hold it. So other oils that are nut or plant oils are considered wet oils, or more properly, non-drying oils. Edible mineral oil, peanut oil or other nut oils, olive oil, and some others fall in this category. The thing with these is wet oils will wash off over time. And I guess that gets confusing is what happened with my linseed oil is it dried out and it probably flaked off or dissipated. It didn't wash off. Just so I don't confuse anybody with that statement. Kevin moment. I would assume coconut oil would be something that you could consider. Certain oils turn rancid, though, but yeah, coconut oil. I wonder if you went out on a warm summer day, would you feel like you're on the tropics doing, you know, double bingo? That's if you like coconut. Sharon happens to detest coconut, so that would be bad. Now, will the bees like it? I don't know. This is what happens when Kevin's working late at night. End of Kevin moment. So there's a couple other things out there that might be confusing. Shellac, which is a natural resin secreted from a bug that feeds on trees, originating from the Asia Pac region, so I learned. Lacquers, acrylics. You know, but most who are looking for natural finishes don't go down this avenue because they have properties that they're not looking for. So I'm not going to go around that direction, but these are wood finishes that people do consider. So another thing about these families of oils and derivatives is, well, sometimes you have to understand how and when to apply them. Technique, drying time in between coats, temperature, they all play a factor on whether you have success. Do it wrong, and you could end up with less than desirable outcomes. Things peel and flake off. Stuff molds. Stuff doesn't ever dry. Crappy finishes. You know, they get dull and blotchy and whatever. There's all kinds of problems with it. So when you're making your choice on these things, your mileage may vary. So perhaps thinking of that, you might really want to go back to painted surfaces. You say, well, then you need to consider volatile organic compounds, or how paints are built, and they're commonly referred to in the paint industry as VOCs. There are underlying formulations and chemicals in paint, and these days you can choose VOC-free paints. I will tell you that I spent my days of my youth operating a side shop. The VOC in paints of my past were far better as a product than the things that they make today. Meaning paint went on smoother, paint lasted forever, paint was shiny. It was all the things you'd ever want. But they were based on chemical formulations that were methyl ethyl death, which the paint industry had to get rid of, and they went through a really rough patch towards the end of my sign career and a little further on, which was the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s. They had to change all their paint formulations because it was just too volatile. Ironic as it was, because one of the reasons I exited the paint industry is because I became tolerant to the chemicals, the thinners and whatever, intolerant, I should say, and just got sick from that and had to get out of the industry because I was not feeling well. That was in the 2000s, around the year 2000 or so. So I'm not sure of the chemistry anymore. I've been away from it too long. But water-based paints used to be terrible back in the day. Everything I used was oil-based for exterior work. But now they've improved drastically after the VOC thing became a concern. And latex paints and industry derivatives of water-based paints had no choice but to hold up better, go on smoother, last longer because people demanded it. So even now, what I know about some of the paints, and I'm jaded because I'm comparing them against what I used to know, they're just not as good as they used to be. But every once in a while, you come across good formulations and you have a good product. And I'll tell you, I always loved Benjamin Moore paints. Whatever reason, their paint systems were great. I tried different combinations. I would paint in this brand, that brand, the other brand, and Benjamin Moore. And I would put them out in my sign shop, behind the shop, and let them sit in the weather. And then Benjamin Moore always outperformed, always. So there's a ton of science in getting paint to be paint, but underneath, and this is my less than expert opinion anymore, but being a sign painter, and as I said, in paint every day for 20 years of my past, It's a combination of an oil, some form of thinner, some resins, and they're designed to carry pigments and additives. And the additives are things that you care about when you're painting hives for honeybees, because they have anti-mildew characteristics, antimicrobial, antibacteria, and they do things like give you scratch resistance, scrub resistance, and so on. The thing about painting a box that you're putting bees in, which is a living organism that create and exude moisture, is that moisture is coming from the inside. Paint systems for houses are designed to have moisture coming from the outside trying to get in, and most houses have moisture control systems in the form of air conditioners and other things, vapor barriers and so on. So it's an odd use for paint for these type of things. So actually, I'm going to go in a completely different spin here, and I will go down the path of paint is paint and tell you what's more important is what you do with the paint. Paint has a very real life cycle that most people don't consider, and it impacts what happens when you apply it. If you leave a can of thinner, let's say turpentine, take a little cup of it and you put it out and you leave it to evaporate, you will eventually end up with a small little resin gummy surface on the bottom after all the liquids evaporate. That thinner is what I would say has chemically dried to whatever its substrate solids would be. That's what paint is at the end of the day. It's liquid so that you could spread it, but eventually all the liquids evaporate out and you end up with the solids in a layer on top of the wood. And the primer helps that solid bind to the wood. It becomes the glue that holds it there. Otherwise, it doesn't stay to the wood. So the first thing is, if you're going to paint your hive, pick a VOC-free style primer made for exterior. Paint your hives and follow the instructions on the can. And I know they tell you it takes 8 hours to dry, but the fact of the matter is, they're trying to get you through as fast as possible, so they're telling you something. But it's not chemically dry. It's dry to the touch, but underneath, if you scratch that skin, it would be wet underneath. You would get paint on your fingers. So one of the things I'll give you as a strategy to paint your hives, if you're using VOC-free paints and primers, put your first coat on, put it on thin. Don't glob it on there trying to get it all covered in one shot, and let it dry. And then put another coat on until the point where you can't see the wood, and then paint with paint. And again, thin coats. Follow the instructions on the can, but most of them actually say this if you read it. Thin coats, multiple coats, at least two. And I'm telling you, your paint will last a lot better. It will be drier better. And the key here is you want to paint early so that your paints can be chemically hard dry before you put bees in the box. You want your linseed oil to be chemically dry before you put bees in the box, or your tung oil or whatever you're using. It doesn't matter whether you're using natural products or VOC-free paints, or if you went to the store and bought methyl ethyl death, and, you know, every one of them is the same way. It's really important to let that coat of paint dry all the way. That's my secret in painting that I convey to you. So hopefully it was helpful. I think one of the other things that beekeepers are worried about is the volatiles in the paint and the impact to the bees and whether they can smell them and whether they'll leave the house, you know, and abscond or whatever. If you do this chemically dry thing, then I think you'd have less impact of the bees being able to smell the thinners and so on. The other thing that I talk about when it comes to beekeeping is there's this some reason there's this notion that people want to paint inside of the boxes. Don't do it. Don't do it. Do not paint the inside of the box. If you read somebody that tells you to do it, smile and nod and move along. The bees will take care of the inside of the box. In fact, I would almost encourage you, because they're finding more and more propolis has to do with the health of the hive and maybe even be a good weapon against varroa mites, is to scratch the inside of the hive to encourage them to propolize it so that it makes a healthier environment. But certainly don't paint it. That's a personal opinion, but one I feel strong enough to say in the way that I'm conveying it. So I think I've talked about this topic a little bit in the past. It's probably a revisit from a previous episode, but worth answering the question again, especially now is the time that a lot of people are trying to paint their stuff. They're a little bit late. They should have done it, but, you know, maybe it's not warm enough to get to your painting, and I would recommend that you do it as quickly as possible now. Do not paint your box and put a bees in them the next week. It's just not a good idea, folks. With segment number one out of the way, I only had one segment prepped for this episode. We'll go ahead to the back of the book. Let's go to roundtable number one. Half Hour Intern is the name of this one. So this is a neat website. It's halfhourintern.com. And if you wanted to learn about a specific topic of interest, I'm guessing, for an intern co-op style person who wants to determine what career they want to go to, you can go to this website and look at the various episodes that they have available. And they have a really nice presentation of different topics: land investor, software engineer, audiologist, and so on their homepage. If you want to see what an immigration lawyer does, what a fashion accessory startup sounds like, you can go there and listen to a half-hour topic of somebody they found in that industry who tells you what this industry is all about. So, of course, this being a beekeeping podcast, you can go to halfhourintern.com/hobbies/beekeeping and see a three-part series, episode 15, 16, and 17, where they talk to beekeepers. These were put out sometime in July 2015. They consist of three different interviews. The first one is small-scale beekeeping. Second one is urban beekeeping, and the third one is large-scale beekeeping. So if you wanted to get into the beekeeping industry, you can get a taste of all three of those types. I came across this in a beekeeping forum where they were asking for people to interview at some point and tracked my way to it. And I thought it was a pretty cool idea, and you can go check it out. It's halfhourintern.com/hobbies/beekeeping, and having a son looking at the college routes right now, wondering what he's going to do when he grows up, might be an interesting place to send them if you have a youngin looking for that same type of thing. We'll have a link to this in the show notes, and you could check it out. Roundtable number two. On our beekeeping forum, someone was selling a Ross Round kit, and Bob Kloss and I were talking about comb honey and doing that. Had we ever considered trying that? We've been poking around looking at ideas of how to learn how to do comb honey. And I came across a video from Mike Palmer on the internet. I think it was actually Bob Kloss that sent the link over. And I was watching it the other day, and he was talking about a specific spot where someone named Richard Taylor had a book about raising hives that did comb honey. And he was talking about using swarms to make comb honey and using the natural instinct of the swarms that are primed and ready to build comb. The way they would do this is they would take the hive swarm and put it on a shallow super of simply foundation with no comb present. So you take the hive, put it in a shallow box, and one of the key things was you either do it at the end of the day so that the hive will stay in there overnight, hopefully make a home by morning, or you put a queen excluder underneath the box so that the queen can't leave and let them set up shop to the point where they start building comb. And one of the things I know about comb honey is in order for them to build in the rounds or whatever the section is, they don't particularly like to build in that manner, bees. So you have to keep them small and compressed on a flow, And when you do that, they'll have no choice but to build honey out. Now, a lot of times when you use something like a Ross Round kit, you put foundation, but it's a special kind of foundation, a thin kind, for them to get started. But if you're eating the comb honey, you don't feel this real thick, chewy comb. You really want the comb to be soft and tender and new. So once they start building the comb, you can remove that bottom excluder. And, of course, you would put the honey supers on top with the comb things in them for them to build out the comb honey. After the harvest of the honey boxes, this little shallow super with a queen in it can be placed on another hive to prop it up. And whichever queen wins, wins. Letting the queen situation do. Or you could put deep frames underneath this hive and see if you can grow it to be an overwinter hive. That's a little weird, right? Because you probably use the honey season to build out the comb honey. And then when the dearth comes, you harvest the honey. And what do the bees have? Nothing to eat. You probably have to feed them and be a little disingenuous to try and do it that way. This is not unlike some of the techniques that people use to make an artificial split. And you could do comb honey that way. Pull a couple frames of bees out, put them in a shallow box or some sort of box, put an excluder underneath, have them build that out, and once they get really full, put comb honey on them and do it that way. You thwart the original hive from swarming by stealing half its population and its queen, and it thinks that a swarm has left, so it does its own mojo over there. And you would do this in a season where the hive was really booming. You saw your first queen cells of the year, and then you would take your artificial swarm out, put them in a box, and fully intend them to be comb honey. And then after the comb honey is done, you can go back and put the hives back together and save that population or prop up that population and make it a stronger hive. So it's an interesting idea. Instead of making a nuke to make a new colony, build a comb-building hive. It's a similar concept. And this is one reason where you might put your queen excluder to use. Roundtable number 3 is another Q&A. I was asked recently if I had any advice that if a hive starved over the winter, but there are some frames with a little capped honey and some of it is uncapped, can you use these frames in the spring? Is there any risk that you put the new package on them and they have concerns about fermentation of the open honey? So how would you answer that? I'll give you a second to think of it. So the answer is a little bit tough, right? Conservatives would say, why risk it? Most practical beekeepers would say, why waste it? I would think on most occasions you could tell by smell. If you stuck your nose into that frame and smelled any fermentation, it would become pretty evident. Or, dare I say, taste it. Stick your finger in it, give it a little taste. If it tastes sour, it could be fermented. I have a different line of reasoning to go through why you would or wouldn't use it. By the time you put a package in, you're getting package when the nectar flow starts, and they're not going to need this. Unless you're propping them up, they're on a nectar flow, and they'd prefer what's out in nectar versus what you're going to feed them. So in this case, you don't want to waste resources, but the key objective for the colony is, do they have food? And since it's being provided by nectar, why risk it? What's the point? So you take the capped honey and put that in there, and chances are they'll uncap it, and they'll either eat it, or they will store it where they want. And maybe they'll leave it there. Who knows? Bees do what their bees are going to do. So part of this has to do with it depends and the timing of it. The other part of it is, was it natural nectar or was it sugar water? And the other thing you have to consider is, are you going to get confused and harvest this later if it was sugar water with your honey? And you don't want to be doing that. So uncapped honey that you found in the spring from a hive that didn't make it through, chances are it came from the fall. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't fermented because it's been in cold weather all winter. But, you know, I would taste it. I would smell it. I would make a decision which type of person you are, conservative or frugal, and then just make your decision and go that way. But at least you have some things to think about in your decision-making process. Roundtable number four, I wanted to mention a video I shot with Joe Lewis. I had mentioned it, I think, in the previous episode. Posted that video one-on-one with him, and during the video there was a discussion about the Jay-Z BZ cage, queen cage. Actually, as I look at it, not a lot of people saw that video. 94 views on YouTube. That's only so far, right? And it's on my BK Corner YouTube channel, which I just started, so a lot of people don't know it exists. Anyway, in the middle of that interview, Joe talked about this Jay-Z BZ cage, queen cage that he knows about. So I think in the interview I said I didn't know what it was, but now that I look at it, I have seen these things. It's like a double chamber queen cage thing that allows the queen to wander around in there and spread her scent and get acclimated, and then eventually you can let her out. That's pretty cool. And you know what? It's 79 cents. So why wouldn't you have one of these? It looks like a far better way to release a queen, which was its premise. I found it on PigeonMountainTradingCompany.com. If you look in their search, you'll find it as the Jay-Z BZ Queen Cage under Beekeeping Supplies and Accessories. And it's 79 cents. So you could buy a gross of these things. It looks like they come in like a clearish blue color or white. You could pick your choice. And, yeah, pretty neat. I'll have to get one of these for the gadget nature of it. So Joe Lewis, had a good chat with him. It was only about 15 minutes long, not a long video to watch, but we caught up to each other. If you go to YouTube and search for BK Corner, you'll find our channel. And there you'll see it's one of the videos that are available. As a follow-up to the last episode, I had asked if people would not mind subscribing to the podcast YouTube channel that I just created. And darn, I really appreciate it. 134 people subscribed, so we hit our mark. There was two conditions to be able to use a custom channel name. Had to be over 100 subscribers, and the channel has to be 30 days old. So as soon as it's 30 days old, we will announce that it has its own URL. I have a couple of videos to post there. I was hoping to get to them this weekend, but yesterday's debacle didn't allow me to get there. So one of them is I went up and took in Raritan Valley Beekeepers Association meeting about a week and a half ago or so, and got to see Charlie Ilsley and David Waldman, both Northwesters, present on two different topics. Charlie was presenting on swarm data and grow degree days, and we filmed his presentation. And David was talking about the Suianti mite monitoring device. And looking forward to producing both of those videos and putting them up for you. That's the one that I had mentioned is going to be in the journal with Randy Oliver, too, as David was working with him. So keep an eye out on our channel. If you subscribe, those videos should be up pretty soon. As far as the discussion with Joe Lewis, you can go watch the video. I was actually thinking, we'll see when we get to the end of the episode, if there's enough time I might tack on our audio to the end of this episode and you can at least hear our conversation. But if you wanted to see it, you can go over and visit the channel and watch it. Roundtable number five. A radical extractor. I did a feature this week on our website on what I use. This is an area where I think on the blog I was just going to talk to people about the things that I use and why I use them and how they work for me. I posted a blog this week on my beekeeping equipment, meaning protective equipment, and specifically my jackets, my veils, my gloves, things that I use, along with some pictures that Sharon took of me. On the course of it, I had to go back and look up some information on my beekeeping suit, one that I use. It's called the Ultra Breeze. And while I was on their website, I found out that the inventor, the owner, passed away, but his family is keeping the company going. One of the things I noticed is my original suit was built in India, per the tag, but their stuff is now made in the United States. Anyway, while poking around there, I found this really cool video. It seems like the guy was a tinkerer. And the guy's name was Bill, and he had a $50 homemade extractor. And what he used was, get this, a ceiling fan from a thrift store. Instead of putting the blades, he made this box that you put your comb in, and you hook the box where you would have attached the ceiling fan blades, and when you run it, it spins the frames around and extracts it out inside the box, and then you just pour it out. So he built two little boxes, screwed them all together out of Luan plywood, and they were dimension enough that you could slip a frame in. And then he built this rig that has a jig that has the thing sticking through where he connected the boxes on an angle, and he turns the ceiling fan on and he just lets it run until the honey is flicked out of the frames. There's pictures of how he did it and what it looks like and how the extracting boxes were and him prepping and painting and doing whatever on the whole project. It's really a good DIY thing, and what a cool thing he built. It's neat. You'll see the rig in the shop that has, you know, the frame that holds it. Yeah. There was some commentary at the bottom about how it performed. Of course, it's designed for somebody who has one or two hives. I don't think you'd run a commercial operation, but in a hot shed, he said the frames came out fairly clean after a 10-minute run. And the motor only runs on 66 RPM. And because the frames are so far, they do extract, but there's not enough pressure to wreck the comb. So it seems like it was a good fit to do the extraction part. On the downside, you got to watch your head. Because normally the switch would be, you know, on the ceiling fan itself, and you'd have these things whirling around. So I think he said he made a remote starter. It looks like one of the tedious things was that he bolted these on, and every time he wanted to undo it, he had to unbolt it. But, you know, I'm sure he could have tinkered further and gotten a better design in some way. So go check it out. We'll have a link to it in our show notes. Roundtable number 6. Listener John Nutley from the UK wrote in. Wanted to say thanks for the podcast. Excellent source of information. Says it keeps him company when he's out and about. He wanted to tell me about rhubarb for varroa control. He shared that there's an article in the Beekeeper's Quarterly, which is a journal that comes out of Europe, one that I'm not familiar with, but I'm going to have to go take a look at. And he thought he would be interested in knowing some my thoughts on. Ann and Maje from Opole in Poland were sharing their experiences of using rhubarb to control varroa mites. He says that rhubarb is a Yorkshire delicacy, and they mix it with custard, and it has a particular zing to it, and that zing is caused by low levels of oxalic acid in the stalks. Yes, John, we have rhubarb pie. My mother used to make rhubarb pie when I was a little kid. And I remember that zing, and the way she countered its sour taste was to load it with sugar and her perfect pie crust, which was amazing. Yes, takes me back. Who knew that we'd come back to it this time for a different aspect? So they've been experimenting by laying rhubarb leaves across the top bars in the brood box. And as the bees work to clean it away and take it out of the hive, they are releasing the oxalic acid that is part of the leaves in the plant itself. So an interesting idea, and something I had heard whispers of in the past, but not rhubarb, different plants. And in poking around after reading this, I found that asparagus, broccoli, lettuce, Brussels sprouts, collard greens, beet leaves, spinach, parsley, and other things have oxalic acid in different levels. It appears, however, when I look at the concentration, that the leaf of the rhubarb is one of the highest ones, so it makes sense that it might be something that people would try. And I'm guessing it's more readily available. There's another thing here called purslane, P-U-R-S-L-A-N-E. And it's got the highest percentage per gram, but never heard of that. Don't know what it is. So as I'm thinking about this, I'm looking at an article that indicates that skunk cabbage and large-leaved houseplants, one I never heard of, contain dangerous concentrations of oxalic acid. So I'm wondering if you could go out and find skunk cabbage and do this rhubarb kind of thing with it. That would be interesting. So what do I think of it? Yeah, I like this. I like this idea. I would imagine the bees would have no choice to clean it up, and as they're shredding and tearing and taking it apart, the oxalic acid is going to be exposed and distributed throughout the hive. Now, whether or not this mechanism will impact the varroa in the way that we want it to, hard to say. What I know is that when you vaporize, you're burning, the acid is burning the hairs on the mites. I think I said this when we were talking about the Sam Ramsey thing. And I'm not exactly sure how the drip works, but I'm guessing that if the mites are coming in contact with this stuff inside the hive, then the possibility exists that it could be effective. The question lies with the percentage of acids that are being exposed through the plant. Are they high enough to cause a problem for the varroa mite? Or are we just giving extra work for the bees and cleaning out extra stuff inside the hive? So from what I've seen, the concentration rhubarb leaves contain a 0.5% to 1% oxalic acid. So I'm not sure how much of that would be needed to equate to the oxalic acid treatments that a lot of people are trying to do these days. So his email indicated that they are claiming a natural mite fall increase of 2 to 7 times during the summer months when it's particularly hard to treat varroa, and leaves in the hives are good shape for autumn treatment as the varroa counts are reasonably low levels when conventional autumn treatments start. So he said they're still doing work on the topic, not sure what's going to become of it, but hey, you go to the local farm stand, you buy rhubarb, you make rhubarb pie, and you take the leaves and you put them in your hives. That's a win-win as far as I'm concerned. You know, we were doing powdered sugar dustings and the bees had to move all that stuff out of the hive. And, you know, there's still jury as to whether it is or isn't effective and whether we were or were not setting the bees back by giving them busy work to do. But in this case, there's a benefit of oxalic acid. And in the powdered sugar, the powdered granules were getting on the bees and helping them groom and other things. So I do believe that these integrated pest management things have a place. And I'd be interested to know if this works and to follow that study or have people do further studies on it. It's far better than us doing what we're doing, which is dribbling oxalic and vaporizing and creating little shop towel rags with oxalic or other things in it. So I like this idea. I'll have to talk around and ask people what they think of it. And if I learn any more on the topic, John, I'll let you know. But thanks for passing that along. So looking at the time left, I think what I'm going to do is wrap it up here. Those are the episode topics that I had laid out in the agenda. I have a couple other things I could probably sneak in here. But actually, I wanted to take a minute and throw in this conversation I had with Joe Lewis at the beekeepers meeting not too long ago. I had mentioned this, and I know some of you may have gone over and watched the video, but if so, bear with me. I'm kind of hoping that more people get exposed to the conversation that Joe and I have, because always a good time to catch up with Joe. So keep in mind, this recording was made from the video camera of us sitting in a classroom. And it's not the greatest quality, but it's certainly listenable. So what I'm going to do is play this one-on-one that we had. And then afterwards, I'll come back and wrap everything up for you. So Joe Lewis from the Westchester Beekeepers Association conference, when I got a chance to pull him aside. Hey, I'm here with Joe Lewis. Joe, you and I, we've met quite a few times, but this is the first time we ever got a chance to sit down and talk.
Good to see you.
True. There's never enough time to talk bees. I love it. So thank you.
Chester County Beekeepers Association hosting a symposium. That's where we're running into each other this time.
Here at Westchester University.
And you're one of the facilitators here, so I've been chasing you all day saying we need to spend 10 minutes to just check and catch up, see what's going on. So what are you up to?
Well, I'm anxious to get the beekeeping season started. You know, we're 29 days ahead this year in springtime in terms of temperature days. Spring's coming early.
Yeah.
And I know the swarms are coming this year, so I know it's going to be a great season.
Do you monitor grow degree days?
Only because Dr. Karen told me yesterday we're 29 days ahead on degree days.
Okay. So I listened to you on Gary's podcast. Well done.
That was a lot of fun.
I'm kind of disappointed that he beat me to you.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
First come, first serve.
It's all good. All's fair in finding guests. And I'm laughing because I see Megan's over there smirking in the background. So 357, I heard you talking about that. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I came up with the idea of beekeeping 357 to kind of give people some numbers to think about when they're, you know, their numbers count. And I always say, when I boil it down to the essentials, I kind of figured out, oh my gosh, you've got to do three things. You got to keep your bees alive, but one of the ways you do it is, you know, you feed them if necessary when there's no nectar coming in.
Right.
You control the varroa mites, and you requeen. And if you do those three things, you're going to have bees for a very long time. So, and that's the three. And then the five is, if you keep five hives of bees, you've got flexibility. You know, you can make nukes, you can make splits, you can move assets back and forth and cross level. And like I learned today, Dr. Melbreth keeps all of her bees at the same level. You know, part of that is cross leveling.
Yeah.
And so, and then seven was the three, five, and seven number of frames that you use to make splits in the year in May, June, and July. The longer it is in the season, the more assets you have to use in order to be successful. Otherwise, you're going to lose that split. You know, I've experimented. You know, farming is beekeeping is about farming.
Yeah.
Farming is about learning the boundaries of failure. Until you learn where the boundary is, you're just going to cross it up all the time. So you've got to figure out what works, what doesn't, and that's what farming is. And that we're bee farmers.
I have a different practical mode of five hives. People who work for a living, that's about the most they can handle.
Ah, now the secret. I'm going to give you the secret.
Go ahead.
You keep some of your bee yards close to work.
Yeah.
You work those on the way home from work, and you call your wife and say, I'll be home at 6:30, maybe 7, have dinner ready, and she'll call you and say, what time do you want dinner tonight?
I'm going to have to change the schedule so I get out of work before dark.
Yes, you do. You've got to get
out. I keep trying to talk my company into letting me put bees on the property.
On the roof.
That would make
a lot of sense.
Yeah. So what do you got going on?
Oh, gosh.
Ready for the season?
Well, no. I'm going to get ready. And the reason I'm going to get ready is because Tuesday of this week, I retired.
Wow, congratulations.
Second time. You know, I did a career in the Army as a military officer.
Yeah.
And then I did a 15-year career as a government civilian working for the Army. And now I'm finished, and now I can give my bees the proper attention because I've neglected them over the years, and I've neglected my animals, and I needed to get to a better
job. I really
job.
Wish that I could retire and go live in the Ozarks or something. I don't know what that means, but I'm envious of you. And Klaus, he's got the same thing. He does nothing but wander out every day and look at his bees.
What a life.
What a life, I'm telling you.
It was good to get to meet you and Bob at EAS this last year, and I'm looking forward to EAS this year. And hopefully you're going to come down and stay the whole week.
Yeah.
And if you can get time off, and because I'm trying to get there for the whole week.
How far are you from there?
Oh, 40 miles.
Yeah.
So,
but maybe you'll have to do a day trip, plan that in.
Yes,
huh?
Yes. I'll show you some of my bee yards.
Nice. How many do you have?
Oh, about 12. You know, some of them.
So you're about 18 now that you're retired. By the time I get to you,
no. I think I've got a hold of what I got. I need to pare down a little bit, actually.
Yeah, yeah, it makes sense.
Somebody said, "How many beehives does it take to make a living?" And I said, "Well, some people say, you know, you can make a living on 25, but I don't know. It kind of depends on how you do it.
Depends on what you do and how much you want to charge for it.
Yeah, and if you're just You know, if you're just fooling around, you're never going to make any money.
I was driving here, hour and a half ride to come over here for me, and listening to podcasts. I don't get a chance to listen to others.
Do you listen to yourself ever? Do you ever listen to yourself?
No.
No.
Well, actually, when I put a podcast out, usually within the week, I listen to it once just to make sure from a production standpoint.
Quality control.
I find things wrong. I cringe at what I say.
I love the Huey Lewis intro.
Yeah.
I slow it down so I can listen to it at normal speed because your Huey Lewis intro is wonderful.
Huey's a man.
And then I speed it up and listen to you at 1.5 speed so that I can get a 60-minute podcast compressed into 40 minutes.
I've been trying to be very consistent from now on at an hour and 15 minutes.
You're doing great.
I'm finding a hard time doing that, but I've been...
so much material to cover.
I know. I'm telling you, I got stacks of stuff to go through. Yeah. So, you know, last EAS, the day before the conference started, Huey Lewis played in Atlantic City.
Oh, my gosh.
I couldn't find anybody that wanted to go with me. And I ended up working late, and I didn't get down there on time, but I was going to go by myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It's a little too much Huey Lewis. So, plans for 2017? Bees? Do you sell honey?
I do, but...
what's the name of your honey label?
Harford Honey.
Yeah.
And I only sell in 2 or 3 stores. And
do you go sell on the weekends?
No, I don't do any weekend stuff.
I can't believe I would do that.
No,
I guess.
It's too
Maybe
hard
in a new life, but
commit,
not in the current
to
one.
To commit yourself to a weekend market, it's like being chained with a ball and chain.
Yeah. So you have an arrangement for a couple of places you sell bees?
I do sell bees, and I love to sell bees. I love to share my bees, and I'm very strict with the people who buy bees. You know, I tell them, you have to study this business. You have to learn how to take care of these bees because I'm not giving you these bees because you're giving me money.
Yeah.
I'm giving you these bees because you're going to love them and care for them and propagate them. And I have some
special... I love that idea. I tell my workers at work all the time, I'm like, look, we don't do this because... we're getting paid. We do this because we love this.
That's right.
We're like this. You need love.
Great. Absolutely. So,
you know, that's a little corny.
Don't
but
think that you're getting my bees because you give me money. Yeah.
The thing is like what I do has a lot of design in it. You're constantly looking at the things you build and you get to see what you look at it and you want to like it. And in your case, you're going to interface a lot with people who buy bees from you. They're going to come back and talk.
Absolutely.
You want to know that they're going to do well and support them.
Year in and year out, they come back, and of course, they're buying. They either call me and say, I need a queen, or and of course, my wife gives me a hard time and says, every time you sell a queen, it costs you an hour, you know, instructing and explaining because I have to ask them, do you know how to install this queen? Why are you buying a queen? You know, I have to interrogate them first before I'm going to release that queen to them. It's like, you're not going to kill her, are you? Do you know how to use a JZBZ cage? What do you mean you don't know what a JZBZ cage is?
I don't know what a JZBZ cage is.
Oh, my gosh. So it'll take me 30 minutes to explain, but I met the guy who invented all the JZBZ, or JZBZ as they call it sometimes, equipment. And he explained to me when I went to the 2008 Sacramento Convention. He said, I invented this little window on the back. It's a get acquainted window. You break out the breakout bar. The workers can go in and out. The queen stays inside until you're ready to release and start the candy eating process.
Okay.
You don't have to buy a really expensive...
You incented me to go look this up.
I
didn't hear it. No, you know what?
You can't find anything online about it.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's only the guy that invented it and me that tell about it. And I tell everybody about
it. Well, you'll have to send me a photo and I'll put it out there.
All right.
But have you seen over in Brushy Mountain, they got that queen introduction
frame? Oh, sure.
Yeah, have one of those.
You spent probably $15 for that.
Yep.
Yeah.
I only bought it for the Gadget Garage so that I could show people the thing.
It's great for Gadget Garage.
It's neat.
I love Gadget Garage.
Yeah. We have a lot of fun. We just did one at Raritan Valley Beekeepers Association recently, and I brought that.
And maybe you and Bob could come down to Susquehanna and do Gadget Garage for us.
Sure.
Let us know. We'll come down
and make a day of it.
That'd be cool.
Anything else you want to share with us? We'll touch base again when we get to
EAS. We'll talk more. It's just great to get to see you and get to share our excitement about our love of honeybees.
Yeah.
And hope you have a great season this year.
I'm looking forward to it. Every year, this is the time, right?
Now, this is my prediction.
Okay.
Last year, we got no black locust. We had the funny weather last year.
I heard that.
2016.
I don't have any in my area, so.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry.
I know. You should be sorry. Because if I had it, I'd be a lot happier.
Black locust is such a wonderful honey. But in the old days, they said black locust would only make 2 out of 5 years. And in this region, the tulip poplar region, they counted on tulip poplar for 100 pounds of honey per hive per year as their standard. We haven't made any tulip poplar honey in this region since about 1990. So it's been, 25 years. So I asked Peter Lintner, author of Garden Plants for Honeybees, the expert on plants. He's going to be one of the main speakers at EAS this year. I asked Peter, I said, why can't we make any tulip poplar honey anymore? He said, oh, it's simple. It's there's no day-night temperature difference anymore at the time that the tulip poplar blooms. You have to have a diurnal temperature range. And he said, it's climate change. I'm sorry, but it's climate change.
Who knew? I have a friend who has black locust right where he is, and every year he kills it. Just kills it every year. And I'm so envious. I wish that, my world is about... I was talking with my wife on a walk, and... said, boy, I wish I could find a good yard somewhere. The magic yard.
Well, location.
Are you in seek of magic yards?
Always. Yeah. And I found some places in my county where there's this dead zone right in the middle. It's like 5 miles wide. And bees never do any good there because there's nothing for them. And I go a little far this way and a little far that way, and everything's okay.
Yeah.
And up here in Chester County, just north of the Maryland-Pennsylvania line, they get more Japanese bamboo, and they get more of this and more of that. It's like, if I just had time to drive another hour and get my bees farther away, it's all about location.
It is.
It really is.
Yeah, but who wants to drive forever to your...
You can't. You can't.
Well, look, I wanted to say one other thing is thanks. You send a lot of stuff in, several of the...
My
Genesis
pleasure.
Of things come from you, and I wanted to thank you personally. And
good
catching up.
I don't hesitate to comment and give you kudos for the great stuff you continue to put out. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Keeping us up to date. Your last article on 104, episode 104, was particularly interesting with the bees learn how bees count.
Yeah.
That was great.
What's funny is I found a follow-up to that. I posted to the Facebook page. Lars Chitka was the doctor from that.
He was
on Science Friday with Ira Flatow recently. Have you seen that video with the bumblebees moving the ball around?
I heard about it, yes.
That's him.
Same
guy.
Oh, my gosh.
From that study from 94.
I'll have to look it up.
And they interviewed him.
That's
really neat.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Joe, it's good catching up.
Thank you, Kevin.
We'll see you at EAS, if not sooner.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
So I hope you enjoyed that little chat. Always happy to catch up with Joe, and I love to feature beekeepers who are doing their thing. And Joe's one of those guys. He's part of the Susquehanna Beekeepers Association. They're down in Hartford in Cecil County, Maryland. And, you look at their board members, Jason Rubin, president, Charles Thomas, vice president, and so on. Those folks do a good job down there. They have a nice website. You can go there and look at classes and workshops that they have going on in their area, speakers. They give a lot of resources and support to their beekeepers, which I think is what it's all about. It was one of the reasons that Joe had come across my path, as I knew that they were a pretty active group down there, and he seems to be part of the equation. So you can check out their website, SusquehannaBeekeepers.com, and they keep it pretty much up to date. April 12th, they have something going on where they have Larry Truckin. I think that's how you say the name, and they have their meetings page up there. So if you're in Maryland, consider yourself fortunate because they have a pretty proactive group down there. Always happy to recognize the efforts of others when they're doing things on behalf of the bees. So cool. And thanks again, Joe, for checking in with us. We'll see you at EAS. So we've come to the end of our time, but you know what? You might have noticed my voice changed a little bit. I got a little bit of a scratchy throat, and it's actually Monday. Sorry. I'm cheating. I wanted to release this Sunday. Just ran out of gas last night, so I committed in to finish things up. But I wanted to throw in a bonus thing that came through today. There's a website, National Phenology Network, Phenology, not sure how to pronounce the name, PHENOLOGY. The website is usanpn.org. Really cool website. They tell you about the temperature changes and things going on. And there's a resource there called the Spring Leaf Index Anomaly, and it's dated March 27th, 2017, which is while I'm finishing this up. And it's information based on NOAA, NCEP, RTMA, and NDFD products provisional data. But what it shows you is where spring has sprung in the United States. And what I'm seeing is the line of spring has come all the way up right to central New Jersey, and it has stopped. The Northeast region, or commonly referred to in our area as the Mid-Atlantic, has yet to see spring. And I concur with that, but I'm thinking this week it will spread. So the whole southern half, about midway through Iowa and the bottom of the Great Lakes down through to Florida, is in spring. And it goes west all the way to just west, literally, of Denver, and then all through the mountains over there to the west coast. There's no spring yet. So definitely a neat resource. Haven't seen this. Going to have to show this to Charlie Ilsley because he just loves grow degree days and weather patterns and stuff. So if you get a chance, check that out. I'll put a link to that map that I was talking about. Really neat resource. So how about that? A little bonus thrown in right here at the end of the episode. So with that, I guess I'll wrap things up. As usual, I will say that if you have anything to say, send a note. Best way to reach me is not through Facebook and all those other things. I really prefer to see it via email. So send me an email, kevin@bkcorner. Just tell me who you are, where you're writing from. Be happy to answer questions if you have them. People do send them along, and I do try to answer them. Been very, very good about that lately, so you won't go into the abyss. I wanted to take a moment and say thanks to anybody who sent along donations. I very much appreciate support to the effort. I don't plug this very much, but every once in a while, I take the time to say thank you. There's a PayPal donation link on the homepage. And I'll remind everybody, if you get a chance, it helps us to get ratings in iTunes so that people know about it. I see a really neat trend here in 2017 is there's a couple new podcasts starting up. And you may get tired of listening to me for all I know, but I appreciate listening to others and not having to listen to myself. So I listen to the basics, Kiwi Mana and others, but have enjoyed, just went through and listened to quite a few of Aaron Jennings' podcasts and stuff. And, you know, so search for beekeeping podcasts on whatever you use, Android or iPhone. Or you stalwarts, I love you, Windows Phone. Hopefully we're going to make a comeback here. Check those out. In fact, let me not be a doofus. I'll give you the actual names of them. Lauren and Andy from Jennings Apiaries, their podcast is called Bees and Stuff. Phil Chandler hasn't put something out recently, but he's got a good archive, Barefoot Beekeeper. Really enjoying the Beehive Jive lately. Solomon Parker has the Treatment-Free Beekeeping Podcast. Of course, the Kiwi Wana Buzz with our friends Gary and Margaret. I really liked when Aaron and Lauren interviewed Gary and Margaret. You really got a good sense of who they are and what they were doing. There's one called the Thinking Bee Podcast and Honey Bee Man, and one from Craig Yearden that was way back, organically managed. Those are a couple other ones, but they're not produced anymore. And I'm sure there's going to be some new ones starting up as they tend to cycle through. So take a look at those and give a listen, because there's always a bunch of really good information out there. One last thing that I will share before we sign off. Go to our Beekeeper's Corner podcast Facebook page. There's a little surprise there. We started the episode with some Huey Lewis, and we could end the episode. You'll actually get to see Huey Lewis in a video that I found on YouTube performing our favorite song. So check that out. Or as always, you can check our show notes. We'll have a link over to that YouTube video of Huey. I love the horns in the background of the song towards the end. You really have to just subtle, but man, horns, they really make a difference. You know what I'm saying in a band? You know what I'm saying. Come on, you know what I'm saying. Okay, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.